so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game? Yeah!
Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah. All right. It's time for another Toy Department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you today, sir?
Good. I woke up feeling fresher than expected, and I feel like my voice is doing every bit as well, if not better, than I would have thought it would, because I spent last night in the company of Wayne Coyne and Company. And yes, I realize I just said the word company in very close proximity twice.
Well, you were in company and he was in company, yeah. Was that another magical fairyland
voyage? Standard Flaming Lips show, although that could also be described as a magical fairyland.
If you've never seen the Flaming Lips, my favorite Flaming Lips intro was when they played the Treasure Island Festival, I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago. And they had a video of a dancing naked lady on screen.
Uh-huh.
And they entered out from that lady's vagina. And came on the stage and started bouncing around, and it was pretty amazing. I was also at the show. If you've ever seen the Flaming Lips, they often have this big bubble that Wayne gets in, and they pass him around. I was at the show where they debuted the bubble.
Instagram at the Kolsky. You can see photographs and videos of some of the things Derek is describing, including the bubble. And I did not get a good picture of it, but one new-ish thing is Wayne rides through the audience on some sort of animatronic horse.
Okay.
Like all around the floor of the Fox Theater on this giant, so you could just see his head, like his whole body, really. Like the horse was about the height of a maybe 6 feet tall. So he's sitting on this 6 foot tall horse, just like sort of floating above the audience. And when he first appeared on the side of the stage, I was like, wait a second, is he just standing on the bar over there? And then no, he was riding a weird animatronic horse that was all lit up with glow sticks and lights. And he got in the bubble and he had several costume changes, and he's just a beautiful, totally fuzzed out and he's basically living in a different universe in his mind at this point, but it's a beautiful universe and it's a very positive atmosphere.
It's a fun place to visit.
It's excellent, man. Yeah. You can feel the love radiating. You know, I don't want to get too hippie about this.
You know, I didn't get to finish my story of the bubble though.
Oh, you said you were at the show where they debuted it. I thought that was the end of the story.
No, the story was that it was a festival set, and they had 50 minutes, and it took them literally 40 minutes to get the bubble working. They never used it before, and then they finally got the bubble and they played it for 10 minutes and passed them around the crowd, and it was amazing. Like,
yeah.
You would think that if you saw a band try to inflate a giant inflatable bubble for 40 minutes and literally do nothing, that it would be a terrible experience. And it was fantastic, and I would recommend it to anyone.
It's funny you say that, because he told a story last night about a time, one of the first times they used their inflatable rainbow, which inflates over, I forget which song it was, but there's a particular song where they inflate this rainbow that sort of is, you know, a big balloon that lies on the ground and then inflates, so it's, you know, probably 12 feet up in the air at its highest point above Wayne as he plays the guitar. And he told a story about once having some trouble with the rainbow and doubting the rainbow, and how ultimately everything, of course, was okay and he will never doubt the rainbow again. But he also... he spent a lot of time exhorting people to scream and yell in a way that again, that's the sort of thing that usually I'm like, all right, enough already. Play your songs, funny man. But he's just this beautiful person. And what I was going to do before we finish your bubble story is I don't want to get too, you know, I don't want to turn into like the weird fish head of the podcast any more than I already am. But like, there is a thing about certain performers, and I recognize it in rock frontmen for the most part, but I've seen it in hip hop artists. I've seen it in stand up comedians, where there are people who are good and great and everything, but certain people just have like an energy, and some of it's, you know, one guy who I always like to talk about in this vein, who you might not expect, is Britt from Spoon. I don't know why I'm blanking on his last name, but
Daniel,
I want to call him Britt McHenry. But yeah, Britt Daniel from Spoon is this dude who's just, he's bigger than you expect, and he just has this sort of electric rock thing coming off of him, and it's a little more aggressive than you might expect from the front man of Spoon, and he's just like this presence on the stage. Wayne Coyne has like I don't even know how to explain it, but he's got like astrological rainbows shooting out of his ass. It's just the joy and the love radiates off of him from the stage, and it's palpable.
You know who is like that for me? This will go left field. Shakira. I met Shakira once. I went to a show, and she's
it'll
like,
"It'll surprise you sometimes."
Very sweet, tiny, tiny, tiny woman. You know what I mean? And like in person was nice. So I talked to her like preset, and she met some fans and some stuff. And then, you know, we went to our seats, and she came out in this, you know, arena show, and like, she's like a god. It's like all of a sudden she's like 50 feet tall or something. It's you just wonder where that comes from inside somebody. But you're right. There is like a really palpable and yet completely undefinable quality about you know, people like that.
It's not so different from the feeling of there are certain actors and actresses who just radiate through your screen. It's hard to say why. You know, they're not necessarily better than the other great actor or actress, but like you see Brad Pitt and he's just like, he's a thing, and you immediately know he's a thing, whether you're looking at him in Selma and Louise or, you know, Benjamin Button. It's just the camera loves this guy.
Yeah. I want you to hold on to that thought, because I actually think that that's going to be relevant to a film we're going to talk about a little bit later on.
Excellent.
In the podcast. We actually have a lot going on today. We've got a guest.
We wasted too much time on the Flaming Lips. My bad.
I know you woke up this morning and you were feeling good, but did you wake up this morning and were you woke when you were up? I think maybe we'll find that out, right?
I'm always woke when I'm up. Right?
We're going to interview Kareth Burke, who is a local a Bay Area sports media personality. Wrote a really interesting piece on Medium about the ESPN layoffs and what it's like to sort of be a person really trying to find their way in the sports media business. And Kareth wanted to know, I think, if what kind of podcast she was coming into, and how woke were we? And how do you think we did?
I think we did good. And I don't want – we shouldn't sound like we're like saying Kareth was being crazy. Like she didn't know who the hell we were.
No, this was a totally normal person reaction, 100%.
Right. She was having a very reasonable, just like, okay, this is – I had met her once in person and we'd spoken for less than 10 minutes. And other than that, we connected on the internet. So
I just felt like it was fun to consider how woke we were, because, you know, we got to have a conversation of like, well, I don't think I mansplained, but maybe I mansplained and I don't know.
We did not go over that with her, which I think was probably the right decision. But she was awesome. We talked about the thing Derek just said and the sports media world and the media world in general. And also she helped us break down the leftovers in a way that I think was very positive as well.
Indeed. So we'll get to that and a couple movies and maybe some Fargo. And here's Kareth.
Okay, so we are welcoming in Kareth Burke, who let's just start with the thing that we didn't discuss but quickly hashed through before we opened the interview, which is your name is Kareth. Your Twitter bio says, if you find another Kareth, let me know. I have not. Where does that name come from?
It's just from a book called The Source by James Michener. I wish there was a better story, but my mom is an avid reader, destroys all books, and that one stood out to her and something that she read. And there you have it, Baby Karis.
Was that a thing that like hung over your head your whole childhood, that you had to read The Source and like understand the name from whence you came?
No, you know what? Not too long ago, she gave me the book for Christmas, and I tried to skim it to see what my name meant, because she can't remember anymore either, and I never found it. But what it meant growing up, what it meant growing up was substitute teachers reading my name as Keith, or never having one of those little, you know, those little license plates you can get for the site. Yeah, never had any of those. Yeah, and actually, I've never met another Karis in person, although I do know that they're out there.
So, you know, Coke has the that bottle campaign where they literally have thousands of names.
Can I order my own? Because I'm never going to find one in the store. No, I'll find Keith. People get me Keith stuff as jokes, which I don't find very funny, but...
Yeah, okay, understandable. We'll avoid those at all costs. All right, so the reason we're having Karis on is beyond the fact that we almost kind of a little bit worked together one time and she seemed like a nice lady, is that she wrote a really interesting article on Medium about the sports world in wake of the ESPN layoffs, firings, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
I guess I should be sensitive about that as someone who was just laid off. I would not want people running around saying I got fired. So layoffs. And sort of what it means for the sports journalism world and for, frankly, people like us who want to work in the sports journalism world. And so let's just kind of start with, can you give us a 2-minute synopsis of sort of where you were at and what made you write it and what your thoughts were?
Yeah, it was just a moment of honesty. It was sort of, I was just getting a little tired of putting on the happy face and, you know, letting my friends know, or pretending to let my friends know, yeah, I have this assignment and this assignment. And I mean, I had like a really great March, but I had a really poor 8 months total. So it was a moment of honesty and frustration, frankly. And then the feeling that I was doing my job search, and then all these ESPN people who are insanely talented are now my competition for the same jobs. It's like, ah, man, it was that moment of realization, like, there's not going to be jobs for all of us. What do I do? It's sort of a chapter in my life kind of thing. I've been a sports reporter and anchor for more than a decade. I've had really awesome assignments. I'm really proud of my resume. But I've had this moment where I've had to think, I wonder if my career is over. I don't want it to be. I still define myself as a sports reporter. I'm still trying to hunt down those assignments because this is what I love. But now I'm making a plan B and a plan C in case things are over before I want them to be.
Quickly, so I'll let you jump in a second, Derek, but something you said that, you know, the impetus is kind of, in a way, the competition that's out there now, and I felt the exact same thing, believe me, especially with, you know, a local guy like Ethan Sherwood Strauss, where, like, I consider myself pretty on top of the Golden State Warriors, but certainly nowhere near as on top of them as Ethan was. And right, I also thought he was a great journalist.
Writer.
So in addition to the competition thing, though, I've been thinking a lot about just what it means about the business, you know, and I think everybody looked at who specifically got laid off and tried to read something into it in terms of, well, what does this mean for what a person has to do to succeed in sports media? And that's something that's troubled me, too, is just, I mean, I can be loud and boisterous and obnoxious, but that's not my goal at all times. And suddenly I feel like if I'm not the loudest screamer around, that's a problem for me.
You feel like it's going to, toward takes, you know, like,
yeah,
how many journalists and reporters are like, we have been trained not to inject opinion in what we're covering. But yet the messaging that we're getting from the industry is like, you need to start doing that. And there's a lot of discomfort in that area. Because then it turns into shouting or hot takes or I don't know. I'm a little uncomfortable with that arena too. There's a way in which I would love to share my opinion more.
Totally.
I would, but you don't hear a lot of women's voices as much, although it's getting better, or people of color, or like as more voices get more, well, they get a louder volume or amplified. I think that's awesome. But then in turn, there's the other side of that where people are like, well, ESPN is pushing an agenda now because suddenly there are different voices. And it's interesting to hear who thinks that there is an agenda now because there's not the same type of person speaking.
The irony sort of, you know, of all that agenda talk is that I think it really, it almost revealed more about the agenda of the person making the comment than it did about the agenda of the media organization.
I really don't think it's agenda stuff, guys. I think it's just bloat. I mean, ESPN did a wildly, they redid their studio. It's beautiful. That cost a ton of money. They pay a ton of money to air the NFL, to air the NBA. All of that costs money, and when you have, it's so unfair. But the first place that you trim is people. And it's so many talented and extraordinary journalists lost their jobs, and that's really sad.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the reasons this has had such an impact with people is because there's clearly more demand for sports content than ever, and yet it seems like the people producing it are more and more fungible. And I if you're in the business, and you know, I'm in the radio business, so this is we're even further down the curve of this maybe than TV sports has been. But if you're in the business, you know that. But I think if maybe you're a consumer on the outside, you don't realize maybe how vulnerable some of these people are, or how many of them are working pretty hard just to get by.
Yeah, I mean, my whole career, I've heard the phrase "do more with less." Do you guys hear that as well? Like the stuff that the budgets are shrinking, workers are, you know, reporters are taking on more to help out. I mean, you don't become a reporter unless you really believe in this because it's not an easy job. It doesn't always pay well. And then people hate you sometimes. So, it's not always the best job, but it's a labor of love for sure. And I hope our political climate has shown that it's an important field. I know we're all in sports, which isn't life or death, but it's just important, and it's fun, and it's what I love. And a lot of people want to do it. It's an awesome job, right? To have this kind of access to the best sporting events and, you know, Hall of Famers. So I wonder, because there's so many people doing it, will people be willing to do it for less money? And I think the trend is yes.
I think that's something that's I've always found. You know, I think the thing that has concerned me about recent developments is the target has moved for me in terms of I felt when, you know, 10 years ago I started doing radio, like, okay, I can do this, and if I do this well, people will want me to do this. Mm-hmm. But what doing it well is exactly has changed over time, and I think a lot of times there's a lot of, okay, well, yes, we've laid these people off. We're not refilling those positions. We're just counting on the people we still have to do more. And you now have these different things to do. And we're not necessarily putting you in a position to do your best because of all the stuff we're laying on you. And then we're going to judge you afterwards on not doing your best. And I think, you know, any business can run into that problem. But the point you mentioned about bloat is really interesting because ultimately, what ESPN knows they need to succeed are the actual sports properties. And that's where a huge portion of their money is going. And it's become very clear that they feel like if they have a couple people to shout about the sports properties, they're not particularly concerned with a responsibility and coverage of them outside of that.
That's a great point. I mean, ESPN's most important properties are the live games. But because it's a 24-hour network, what do you use to fill in the hours when there's not games? So there is some intelligent conversation going on. I think there are a lot of things you could talk about in the sports world that don't involve shouting or pokery. Yeah. But it's a little easier to have four or five talking heads who don't mind getting into that territory. I often wonder, do the take artists, are they performing or do they believe what they're saying? It's hard to figure that out.
I spent so much time wondering that.
I have too. I feel like it is performative from what I, at least the glimpses of what I hear, like people who spent time with, I'm just going to start calling out names, I guess, you know, with a Stephen A or, you know, Skip Bayless worked in the Bay Area for a while. So there are people around who do like know him as a guy, and you hear that he's a, he's like a genuinely nice person when he's not heel turning on LeBron James.
I've heard that too.
And yeah, so I do think some measure of it is performative, but I also feel like, you know, we're all people who've gone on the air. It's, you can't fake it totally day after day, right?
So no, you can't. And you've got to live with yourself, man. Which,
right.
Which I've been trouble with.
So they have to be somewhat invested in this stuff at the very least, right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, you know what? I've had a lot of college students who are graduating, and they've gotten in touch with me after reading my thing, and they're like, should I still do this? Or what keeps you going? Or how can I separate myself? And some days I have advice for them, and some days I just can't write back. I'm trying to get in touch with every single person who's taken a moment to write me an email or write me on LinkedIn just to say thank you at the very least, or to try to write back with a little advice.
That's something that I've struggled with so much in my career in general. When someone like that reaches out to me, and it would happen, you know, once a month or so when I was still on the air regularly. And so I think for someone like me, who I would say it's been about 50-50 when I have done something like that over the course of my career, reached out essentially cold to someone who I respected or admired or read or heard something that I liked and said, hey, I'm trying to do this. Do you have any advice? You know, the people who – it came in two packs. Basically, one pack said it's the best job. It's incredibly difficult. You're going to run into a lot of challenges, but I love it. I still love sports. I'm still convinced I'm here for the right reasons, and I should be here, and here's some things you can do. And the other half said, it's a terrible business. Avoid it at all costs. And I got so mad at those people. I was so...
And yet they were totally trying to help you.
They were. But I remember what it felt like and how much I felt like, you know what? Like, I'll find my own discouragement, buddy. I don't need that from you. Like, just don't even respond. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. But listen, I do now think about how to balance telling people the truth with also telling them that, yes, I am in many ways living my dream, even though I know I might be unemployed tomorrow on any given day.
Yeah, they gave you the most honest advice they can, and you didn't want to hear it, and I understand that. That was some ugly advice to dole out. What I'm discovering is I've had a great path, and I've loved this journey. And even if I know how hard it is, I cannot type the words that would discourage somebody from following their dream. So what I tell them instead is I lay out how tough this is. I lay out the competition, and then I say at the end, only you know if you have the heart to do this. Because you might want to, but you might not want to put in the work. You might be unsure. That might be why you're emailing in the first place. You really need to gut check yourself and see if you want to go through this. And only you can answer that question.
Yeah, I tell people. In fact, I just did an interview with like a radio industry site this week. And that was one of the first questions they asked, like, knowing, you know, what you've gone through, would you recommend radio to people? And my answer was, you know, do this if you feel like you can't do anything else. If you feel like this is what you need to be doing with your life, then it's probably the right place for you. You know, and otherwise, find something that's going to pay better and going to offer you more security. And I tell every, like, anyone who comes into the radio station and asks me about, like, schooling or whatever, I say, don't major in broadcasting. You know, take the classes or whatever, but, like, have another major so that you have something else to do. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're only hiring on tapes and experience. You know, what you did in school isn't really going to matter. So do your school thing, but have a B and C path, because you may need it someday. I'm at the point now where I'm 20 something years into a career. It's the only adult job I've ever had, you know, and so the idea of transitioning to something else, which I certainly thought about many, 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 many times. It's just hard for me to break away because this is what I know and this is what I know I'm good at.
It is. It's. I'm having that trouble too. Like a chapters of my life thing. I thought I would get to decide, and maybe I still do. I'm really holding out hope that the work that I'm doing to work my connections in sports, and I mean, right now, guys, I do Pac-12 network stuff, which is awesome. I love it. But the schools are getting out for summer, so there's nothing to cover right now. So I have to work my plan B to pay the bills, and then see. I guess what I've had to realize lately, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe this forces me to think about my next step a little earlier than I thought. But if I do see an expiration date for myself in sports, then maybe I need to start looking for the next thing now instead of trying to hang on.
Yeah, I mean, the sooner the better.
I don't know. I don't want to be pessimistic. This is exactly what I love. There is a sports job that I want so badly that hopefully I can find out if I get it at the start of fall. And, like, I've got so many emotional eggs in that basket. I don't even want to name it. I want to keep it right inside my heart. But if I get that, then I will be able to exhale. And if I don't get that, I think that might be my signal that it's time for something else. So,
well, and something you said really jumped out to me because, you know, you and I are in not two different boats at the moment. Part of being someone who, at the moment anyway, is more of a gig-to-gig sports worker versus a full-time sports worker. As you said, you know, I'm working my connections, and I think I'm on the right path. And I feel the same. You know, like there's a couple of things I see on the horizon in a couple of months that it's like, all right, that's a thing that could really happen, and I feel pretty good about it. The problem is, being in this position, it's a lot of, well, here I am. And
here
now I'm waiting. You know, it's yeah, yeah, I've worked my connections. I've talked to people. I've had the right meetings with the right people and gotten the right feedback, and things look good. But also, like, if I sit down in front of my computer right now, there's literally no thing I can do to progress my job search. I just have to wait for the connections to work the way I hope they will, or for, you know, the job application for the thing that starts in 3 months to get looked at. And so much of it is I've got these four irons in the fire, or more accurately, 15 irons in the fire. And I have no idea when they're going to pay off. So deciding, like, where am I even at right now? What actually is my status is even a hard thing to do.
Yeah, you've controlled what you can control, which is great.
Right.
Like, I hope you feel empowered for that. But now it's that waiting for everyone else's timeline and action. And there's such a powerlessness in that. There's like a that feeling frustrates me so much because there's nothing more you can do. You just have to put that stuff in the universe and hope. Which isn't much of a solution. It feels like crap.
And I'm sure you're like me. It's like I get great satisfaction out of being able to work towards something. Having actionable items is a great relief for me. And so kind of feeling like you're floating is a tricky thing.
Yeah. And you know what, Matt? It sounds like in ways you've had it tougher than I have, because when I moved to San Francisco is when I started freelancing. All of my other jobs beforehand were full-time and reliable, and I knew those jobs in and out. And now I've had to scramble on my own a little bit more. And I'm terrified, frankly. Like, it's really freaking hard. You know, I wrote that thing in just a moment of honesty, and just to say, like, I'm doing what thousands or millions of other Americans are doing now. I'm paying the bills with a different job. I work at Whole Foods. It's kind of awesome, actually. It's a great little job. But that's not what I went to school for. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of people at that job who are going to school for things. Like, one of my bosses is in law school. I mean, everybody's got, like, their side gig, or everybody's working two or three jobs nowadays. And it's tough, man. It's tough. I saved a lot of money. I'm doing okay. I'm working at Whole Foods. So we'll see what happens. We're going to see what happens. I'm going to give it until the end of the year and then really have to make some hard decisions.
Kareth, can I ask you something? It's kind of personal. In the article, you mentioned that you wound up coming to the Bay Area for love, right?
Yeah.
And that's a situation that I can relate to. I've, you know, had a lot of times when I've been in a relationship and you get that call that's like, okay, well, we want you to start in this other city halfway across the country in 2 weeks. And then you have to make that decision about your relationship. And for me, pretty consistently, I've chosen my career. You kind of went the other way. How do you feel about that decision now? And just on a personal note, are you still in that relationship?
Oh, yeah, I'm absolutely in this relationship. Essentially, you're asking me, do I regret leaving?
Delicately? Was it delicate? I hope it was delicate.
No, I've gotten that question a lot, actually. And, like, it's hard to explain to people how deeply happy and satisfied I am in my personal life, but how adrift I am professionally. But the personal side is what's getting me through, actually. My partner is incredible. He is the love of my life. So from that perspective, this has been tremendously easy. He works a job that he needs to do here, whereas mine is a little more flexible. So I knew that. I knew it was a risk. I knew it was a risk to come out here when I didn't have a job lined up already. I'm living that risk right now. It kind of sucks, but I'm going to be okay. I think by putting the personal first, that's what fits my life best right now, after a decade or 12 years of putting career first and working nights and weekends and working holidays and wondering, am I going to be single for the rest of my life? And then the best thing came along. So I followed him, and I do not regret that at all.
Yeah. And by the way, the trade-off to that, of to not making that decision, maybe this will make you feel better, is that I'm still asking that question, am I going to be single for the rest of my life? So
yeah, I was going to say, like, yeah. that refrain sounds very, very familiar. So you're talking to the right audience. Speaking of, I'm going to yank this in a different direction now.
Okay, cool.
Speaking of being alone for the rest of your life, I'm going to tell a quick story, which is I had a brief chat with Kareth just to sort of say hello and assure her that we were not going to engage in like a weird verbal warfare of some kind.
Well, I just didn't want to be about my experiences, you know, like, well,
yeah.
Or, you know, have you tried this? You know what? There are so many well-meaning people on Twitter who think they will change my life with, like, one tweet, like, have you considered?
And hey, have you thought of applying to... No, yes, I've thought of it. I've thought of everything that you've thought of, I assure you. No, but the... delightful thing that came out of this was that almost unprompted, Kareth brought up the show The Leftovers, which of course listeners of the podcast know.
Woo!
Has been a bit of a battle the last couple weeks.
I'm on the pro Leftover side of this battle. Just want to point that out.
Are you caught up?
I caught up at around 2 a.m. last night. I watched episode 4 of season 3, and I have to I have to issue a mea culpa.
Yes!
The show is phenomenal.
Yes.
And, first of all, I could watch Carrie Coon eat breakfast, and I think that could be a show that I would watch every week. But also... Man, I mean, somehow this show has combined like the drama of a deep, thoughtful, philosophical, sort of heartbreaking story with the mystery aspect of something like Lost. And I'm so locked in and alternately confused and delighted, and it's funny in ways I wasn't expecting. I'm kind of blown away by this show.
Oh, yeah, some fierce moments of humor. Okay, I want to know the ground rules of your podcast. Are spoilers fine?
Like, yeah, you can spoil.
Everybody's caught up? Okay. The scene at the end where Carrie Coon's character was crying, it looked like she was crying when she had all the...
With the water?
The sprinkler water, yes. To me, that felt like such a relief. Finally, she gets to mourn, and she's mourning her children, and she's mourning the end of her relationship, and she is just cratered. Like, that I want to rewatch that breakup scene again, because they're literally in a burning room laying it all out and killing each other. It was tremendous.
Yeah, the cinematography of that scene too is just gorgeous. Like the shot of her on the bed with like the sprinklers coming down, and then the really tight shot of her face with like just you can't tell what's her tears and like what's just water running down. Like it was a very powerful moment in a show that's kind
I'm thinking about this now. Was it even in black and white? I meant to rewatch it, but I didn't. Was that in
the
black
last
and
shot? Was not black and white, but it was so dark that it was. It was high contrast. I can see why you would remember it that way. I also want to mention, and you guys are like probably this is a year ago for you, but it's just a couple of days ago for me. The scene with Regina King, where Carrie Coon steals the questionnaire from the dude. Who's there to find out if Evie and the other two girls actually departed.
Yeah.
And she steals the questionnaire and goes to Regina King's house, and they're just sitting across from each other. And Carrie Coon asks her some of the questions, and then they kind of break script. And Carrie Coon gives this speech where she's like, it's a bunch of BS, and like, she's angry. And then they have this stare-off. That's
they're
just
slicing
like
each other with their eyes. Yeah,
oh,
that's the
my God. And it's just like these are two women at the top of the game, just devouring each other. It was so awesome to watch. There's so many scenes of like high intensity, tight shot scenes in this show that are done so well.
Yeah, and then, well, how about Carrie Coon's character? Oh, why am I blanking on her character's name, by the way? Regina King's character
Nora.
Is named Erica, I think. Nora, duh. Okay, so when Nora goes and seeks out Erica, though, and then they have the scene where they're jumping on the trampoline.
Oh,
I mean,
it's incredible. To the Wu-Tang.
Yes.
The music in general in this show is phenomenal. They it's as, I said this last week as I had watched maybe the first season and a half. It feels loud. Like, I feel, it's funny because we're going to talk about another Carrie Coon show later, Fargo, which also does really interesting things with music and did this week. But I feel like the music on The Leftovers is very in your face. There's the one like Leftovers theme that plays, and that's not always as loud. But every time there's a song, like whether it's the Wu-Tang Clan or Cat Stevens, it feels like it's louder than music on normal TV shows. And all the songs seem to have, like, if you know the music, you can immediately understand sort of the reference it's tied into in the show. I just think it's such a cool use of the soundtrack.
Yeah, there's a cue that it's given viewers.
Yes.
And you're right about the volume. Yeah, that this is music that you can't ignore. So it almost becomes like its own character or its own signal that you need to pay attention to this. We're giving you clues or meaning here that'll give you hints about what the scene is about. And it gives it a deeper meaning in there, which I like what they're doing with the opening credits now, too. This whole season. You know what? I actually said I would be fine if The Leftovers ended at the end of season two. I was unsure about. I thought it could have been a perfect button up. Didn't one of the characters tell Justin Theroux's character, like, I have no idea what's going on? I just found it perfect. But I'm glad that there's a season three now, and it's been even better than season two, which I don't know how this is possible. And I think I read that this season is only 8 episodes long.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the same? So we're halfway through already.
Yeah, I think just given Damon Lindelof's prior TV experience, I think he's obsessed with sticking the landing on this one. And so I think, you know, I agree with you that season two would have been a fine place to end it, but I think he really went to the network and they sort of worked it out. Because, you know, they're still, believe it or not, a ton of people watching the show. But they're like, look, this, I think, you know, one more season, 8 episodes. I know where we want this to go. I think this would be a good way to end it. And HBO said yes. And I think that's how we've gotten to where we are now.
How many people are watching? It's a loyal base, but that doesn't mean it's big. Is it like a million? Is that it?
I want to say typically an episode does under a million. Don't hold me to that.
Okay, I mean, I get that it's not for everybody. That's fine. Sometimes you want your TV to be a little bit more mindless, but
you know what, though? As a longtime Leftovers denier, I have to say, I have a longstanding policy that is well-worn territory on this show that I don't love and try to avoid bad time entertainment. And that was why I avoided The Leftovers, and I was just wrong. I mean, it is tough
like
at times.
Gloomy stuff?
Sorry, what?
Bad time entertainment. Gloomy, like gloomy things?
Yeah, exactly. Oh. Stuff that just is like just a bad hang, you know?
Okay.
Like I have enough bad hangs in my daily life. I want to enjoy myself when I'm watching media entertainment, but I do think to view The Leftovers in that regard was a mistake by me, because like I said, it's difficult at times. The characters are in depressing situations quite often. But it's deeply entertaining, well-made television that's not just, you know, I think of something like Blue Valentine or The English Patient, where it's like, what am I doing here besides getting sad? And this is not that. This is better than that. You're doing lots of things besides getting sad. And yes, I have a problem with The English Patient. We don't have to read that.
Oh, no. So does Elaine. You know, I'm pretty ruthless with shows too, and I'll watch something for a while and then just drop it. Because you're right, I want to have like a decent time, or I want to be entertained when I watch things. I do want to be invested. I recently gave up on The Americans. It's like, I know that's one of the prestige television shows.
You just hit another hot button topic on the podcast.
The Americans is boring the crap out of me this season. And oh, last man. Season it was a little tough too. It's the pace.
This was going so
guys.
Well.
It's the pace.
No, right on, Kareth. Do your work.
Wait, do you agree with me, or do I need to justify myself here?
I'm firmly in the Americans corner.
Daryl's okay. Team Americans. I found The Americans too boring around episode 5 of season 1. I still can't get any further than that.
Okay, it's the acting is good. The first 3 seasons are fine. The Paige storyline in season 4, and then even now. I mean, like, the whole Pastor Tim stuff isn't even a factor anymore. The whole really uncomfortable Kimmy storyline. She popped up once. I mean, it's like...
Both of them have come back in the last couple of weeks. And Pastor Tim kind of Pastor Tim in a major way.
I don't know. Bugs and wheat, man. Bugs and wheat. I don't care.
I mean, to me, this is always a show really about the marriage. Or the sort of marriage and the crazy dynamics of the marriage. And there's so much in that. And yes, a lot of it is sort of an internal show and relies a lot on the acting of the leads. But some of it is, I mean, there's so much great like spy maneuvering and all these capers and like,
the
you know.
The wigs are cool. Sure. The wigs are great.
It's
whatever
so many
happened
wigs.
To the S stuff?
Like, oh, that's still going.
On the verge of breaking and like. I don't know. I've been disappointed. I've been trying to pinpoint why, because I am invested in the show, but why is it just not resonating with me anymore? And I don't know. I can't answer that. I recognize that other people love the show. I recognize that it's still well done, but something in me broke away from it. It's a shrug.
If I could offer a theory, maybe I'm arguing against myself now, but like, you know, when you look at a show like Leftovers, which will just do stuff like, hey, let's pay off this Perfect Strangers gag from season 1 by bringing in Mark Lynn Baker.
And
he happens to have 2 drama degrees from Yale. And he turns out to be this really amazing actor, you know, or the, you know, Fargo, you know, doing bonkers things that a show like The Americans, where that action is more subtle and internal, I could see how for a lot of people, maybe that seems lesser. But I said that like for a lot of people, but I don't really mean it like that. I just mean like, I get it. Like it's not as fireworky a show as maybe some others are.
And that's okay. I've watched some non-fireworky shows. The Americans isn't doing it for me. Leftovers, doing it for me. Woo.
All right, well, I'm 1 for 2 today.
Like, I am obviously, as you must have realized, Derek, I am seizing upon Kareth's position as a reason to never, ever watch the remainder of The Americans.
Yeah. It'll
be a great disappointment to both you and my younger sister, who keeps insisting that I watch it. But I apologize. I've just been given a free pass.
Can we
didn't mean to get in the middle of anything, guys. I apologize.
Can we get your younger sister on the pod? We'll just...
she would talk to you about The Americans. You know what? Let's look into that. Next guest, Emma Kolsky, discussing The American.
By the way, I did look it up. The season premiere of The Leftovers, 900,000 viewers. Which is an okay number for cable. An okay, but not great.
HBO, yeah.
Okay, maybe it's one of those things that viewers come around to. You know what? It took me... I think I started watching Mad Men when it was in the 3rd season. I needed to be coaxed a little bit because I'm like, oh, the show's so great. Oh, yeah. Every critic is like, the best show on television is, and in parentheses, it's the one that I watch. So, you know, the best music out there is what I listen to. And Jesus, man.
Yeah, that's my whole life right there.
Yeah,
that sense.
Mad Men was great, but it is not the best show that was ever created. No.
What is the best show that was ever created in your mind?
I have no idea, and I refuse to answer that question. I don't know.
Because
I actually know what I like. Breaking Bad really resonated with me. For the first time, there was a show that I would flip out if I missed it. I was in a... I don't know. Okay, I guess I'm going to go for it. I was in a pretty dark place one season when I was on the road a lot traveling with the team. Like really sad, and it was like, you know, if I can just let me just Breaking Bad every Sunday night became the marker for me, like something to achieve. I can watch the show, I can enjoy the show, and then like I had something to look forward to all the rest of the week. That's pretty sad. That's dark.
Yeah, but it's a dark show. Like you, it fit that time in your life, I guess.
Yeah. Breaking Bad's my answer too. So I guess I'm gonna forgive you for this.
The answer is obviously The Wire. I'm not sure why we're having this conversation.
I mean, The Wire's great. Why isn't the answer MASH, or why isn't the answer Mary Tyler Moore Show?
Quite obviously, Kareth, because I have not watched the entirety of either of those shows.
Why is it the best show on television, Sesame Street? I mean,
fun fact.
Right?
Did you know?
Yes.
1975 was the first year of Sesame Street. They recently released that year on DVD, and I believe, don't quote me on this, but I believe it was rated PG-13 because Snuffleupagus was literally Big Bird's invisible friend. The street was so broken down and dingy that like it really did not look like a place for kids so much as a place for like heroin on the streets.
New York I grew up in. That makes sense. That's good.
Exactly. Like the original Sesame Street is like it's the village in the 70s and it's not for kids at all.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Fun facts. All right.
Yeah. Fun facts about Sesame Street. Bet you didn't know you were going to get those today.
No, this has been a very rewarding experience, Gareth. Thank you.
We aim to please.
Listen, Kareth, we really, really appreciate you taking the time. It was a great conversation, and obviously, best of luck, and hopefully, we'll talk again in the future.
Yeah, if you get that kid whose name you can't speak of, please let us know.
If I get that job, the whole world will know if I get that job.
All right.
Thank you so much, guys. Hope to run into you down the road.
All right. Cheers.
Bye.
All right, so thank you to Kareth. That was really cool of her to come on. She was great.
She was great. I meant to mention while she was talking to us, but I was probably just so like gratified that an adult human considered hanging out with me in real life that I got distracted was that given her intelligent take on The Leftovers and like seeming general pop culture awareness that like the Kareth and Kolsky show could be a good alternative to The Toy Department if anything ever happens to you.
Are you're just plotting my replacement already?
I'm just saying if something should happen. I'm not wishing, okay?
All right.
It has a nice ring to it, does it not?
I will just be watching my back from now on.
Look, man, what if you and 2% of the world just disappears in a week? There's only 8 days left, man.
That's true. You never know. I could just depart and then I'm just glad to know that you have everything lined up in that occasion. All right, let's talk about Fargo. Because you can't talk about that without the guy from Minnesota, right? I'm here. I'm essential to this discussion.
You're going to probably have to start doing an accent, I guess, right?
Well, it can't be worse than Ewan McGregor's. Have we talked about that at all? I feel like maybe I've mentioned that. He's doing a great job. It's an excellent performance. I feel like he gave up on the accent like somewhere like halfway through the first episode, and he's just doing a Scottish brogue mostly.
Yeah, I think that's a fair criticism. It's a tough job that he's been given, because ultimately we know he's playing twins that are supposed to be two completely different characters, but we also know it's Ewan McGregor, so it's hard to get totally out of that in your head.
And the accent is fairly specific, the Minnesota accent, I gotta say.
It is very specific, and I do think he's generally doing a good job. And certainly he's not taking away from the show for me, but to me the show is... each week I am excited to watch Carrie Coon and to watch what weirdness Noah Hawley has cooked up. And this week it was a Peter and the Wolf theme.
Was that what that was?
Yes.
So you're so much more cultured than
I have that record. In fact, before I was forced to come out to my car to record the podcast because the cleaning crew is here, I had considered dropping the needle on my own Peter and the Wolf record at the moment we began to talk about this on the podcast. But
that would have been super cool, but I'm glad you didn't do that for copyright issues.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point. But it was. I thought it was so cool.
Yeah, I would. I really loved that intro to the episode. And look, obviously, I'm on record on this podcast already today with how much I find Carrie Coon to be delightful. But to me, she's just one cog in this, you know, in the show, particularly in an episode like this that takes place back in the town. And there's so many great characters, you know.
The bulimic gangster.
Yeah. You know, who's the wolf in this episode?
He's the wolf. He's also Remus Lupin from Harry Potter.
Yeah, that I would not know. But I'm going to take your word for it. You know, I've never seen a Harry Potter movie.
Why?
Because I'm not interested.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I guess they're not really your bag. They are pretty good.
Never read a book. Never seen a movie. And I plan to keep it that way.
All right. I mean, anyway. That seems like an odd determination. The books, several of them are really quite fantastic.
I wouldn't dispute that. I'm happy that many millions of people enjoy it. Not for me.
You're a grown up. You make your own life choices.
Yeah. No, I'm comfortable with it. But yeah, like there's so many great characters that come into this universe, and you know, you don't necessarily know how long they're going to be here. Like the cop that she meets in the bathroom,
the lady cop,
I have a feeling we're going to see her some more. But like,
yes, but if it had just, this is a great point. If it had just been the bathroom scene and you never saw her again, she would have been a delightful addition to the show.
Yeah, or even the lady at the bank who I don't think we'll see again. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like. It's such a well-crafted world, you know.
And it is very, I feel like this season more than the first two is very Coensian.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I mean, somebody said this. It's the most Fargo this show has ever been, and
it's the most Coen Brothers. Yeah, in fact, someone even said that's not the preferred nomenclature in this episode. Did you notice that?
I did notice that. Yeah, like I think. I don't know. I keep coming back to that piece that dude wrote. We've talked about a couple times. It's been discussed elsewhere about, this is formula. And I'm like, it just seems nuts to me. Like, yeah, there are beats. There are beats that you might recognize. But, like, it's so artfully presented to you.
This was the thing I thought about a lot while I was watching the episode, that I wanted to say today how disgusted, confused, and just sort of annoyed I am by the Fargo criticism I've seen this year. It shows to me to take the approach to watch what this show has done. And I guess if you wrote it after episode one and not having seen anything else, then I guess maybe I understand a little more, except that that's pretty dumb and irresponsible. But the watching four, five episodes of this show so far this year, if you feel like this is formula or somehow rote or repeating what happened in the first two seasons, it shows such a limited capacity to see originality beyond the broad basics of a story. Because nothing outside of the very broad basics is rote or formula on this show.
It's like, so I get, right? You get the, like, yes, Ewan McGregor and, you know, and his girl are in over their heads, and the dogged cop is going to eventually sniff them out. But, like,
but that's like saying point. Every gangster movie's the same.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like, so this is Law and Order. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
exactly.
If you think that the show is incapable of surprising you, I don't know what show you're watching.
Exactly. This show, who could have thought you would get a weird cartoon slash, I don't even know what to call the thing from the previous week, cartoon slash flashback episode followed by a Peter and the Wolf themed episode. Like, this is creative television making at its finest. Yeah. And I just think maybe the thing we're learning more than anything else is that for the medium of television, Noah Hawley is an incredibly creative and interesting artist. And I'm just so excited that he's become such a big thing that we get to see all these different creations of his mind. I just think it's whatever's going on inside that brain is so interesting, and I'm thrilled by it.
Yeah. I think the other thing we've learned is that, you know, everything needs a backlash, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that, you know,
welcome to 2017.
Yeah. And maybe that gets into some of what we talked about with Kareth, in that it's like, well, no one has staked out a take on Fargo Stinks Corner. So, you know, let me be the first.
And look, I've never heard of it.
I think his name is Eric Thurm, and I only know that because he took this position. You know what I mean?
That's exactly right. And here we are being part of the problem by discussing it three times in 3 weeks.
It's like, really, we probably should let it go.
But to get briefly back to touching on the stuff we talked about with Kareth, that is part of the problem with this avenue of the culture, is that it's hard not, if someone has a take that is controversial, even if you're not sure of its sincerity, it's hard not to address.
Indeed. All right, should we jump to movies? Because I did the homework this week.
That's rare enough to deserve its own podcast.
Not only did I do the homework, I spent money to do the homework. And not only did I spend money to do the homework,
I feel a little bad, I should say.
I wandered into the theater on a gorgeous Saturday afternoon where there were lots of people there. Just all those people wanted to see Guardians of the Galaxy. And did I see Guardians of the Galaxy? No.
Well, that was my mistake. We could have done Guardian. We could and should have seen Guardians of the Galaxy.
I sat in the theater with literally one other person and watched The Lost City of Z.
Okay, now, so first of all, I will say, the Guardians of the Galaxy thing was nothing more than an oversight. I forgot it came out this week, and we should have seen it and talked about it. We're going to be behind.
Right, because people are going to go watch that. I'm fairly sure no one is going to watch The Lost City of Z.
At this point, we're probably not going to talk about it on the podcast. Now, I knew... not many people would see Lost City of Z, and that was why I wanted us to see it and talk about it, is because from what I had heard about it and read about it, it seemed like something that was worthy that we were not going – that like wasn't going to be as well tread territory. You know, everyone's going to survive if we don't talk about – I mean, whatever. Everyone's going to survive no matter what, but plenty of people will talk about Guardians of the Galaxy. You don't need our review for that necessarily. You probably already have decided whether or not that interests you. I do think this was an interesting movie to review. It wasn't quite what I expected. I imagined it as, not a similar movie necessarily, but structurally Apocalypse Now, going deeper and deeper into the jungle. And in a way that happened, but it was multiple trips. There was more sort of back in civilization, and it was more of just telling the story of a man who really lived in the world than it was a jungle adventure movie. So it was not quite the ride I was hoping for.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know. I just thought it was going to be maybe more of an emotionally resonating movie. And I feel like the parts where it tried to do that were largely unsuccessful and in a way kind of bloated the movie. It's a really long movie.
It's very long. I actually think, I mean, you're not wrong, but I think the problem was they didn't follow through and pay that stuff off enough.
Well, but I mean, didn't you find I felt like all the home life scenes were fairly boring and predictable.
That's right. I felt like every time they went back to England, I was like, why are we back here? I was like, go deeper into the jungle. And instead of a story about progressively going deeper into the jungle, it was kind of a story about a man and his life wherein he goes to the jungle once, gets a little bit, goes another time, gets pretty far, and then eventually goes again.
And also, like it's a man struggle to convince people to care about this thing that he really cares about.
Right, and I don't know. I feel like if it had been sold as more of a biopic, I might have been more ready for that. But I felt like it was sold as like a journey into the jungle, and I think I don't want to say it failed because there was a lot of good stuff about it. I mean, I thought a lot of it was well done. The jungle stuff looked incredible. I thought it was shot really well. Those scenes in particular in the jungle, but it never gripped me like I was hoping it would. I feel like it might have if it was more of a narrative story and less of a biopic.
Yeah, I also agree in that I don't think this was worthless or I'm not gonna say you're gonna come out hating it. I didn't hate the movie, but I felt like it ultimately was kind of unsuccessful. And
right, unsuccessful is the word. It just didn't quite get it done. It wasn't bad, but it was unsuccessful.
And I was very surprised to, because I went to the Metacritic page and now I'm back there again.
It's very well reviewed.
It's very well reviewed. 78 score, which is pretty good. A lot of really kind of glowing reviews. I think the biggest problem for me, and this was, you may recall, an hour ago when we were talking at the beginning of this podcast, about people who have it. And yes. I am not here to bury Charlie Hunnam. He's been in a lot of things that I really like. I enjoyed Sons of Anarchy. He was an undeclared, and I stand for people from the Apatow universe all the time.
Yeah.
But I find him to just be wooden. And
He does not pop.
He does not have that thing that he's very handsome. But doesn't have that thing that makes you compelled to watch him,
It makes me wonder if it's a thing that can be gained or manufactured. Because when I see the previews for King Arthur, I'm kind of in. But I will say I was more in on King Arthur after watching the preview before Lost City of Z than I was at the end of Lost City of Z.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, Hollywood's going to serve this guy up. Like he's going to have his opportunity. So, the people will decide whether or not they agree with what I'm saying. But and I think this King Arthur will be an interesting test for him. I heard.
Interesting though, Colin Farrell was in this position once.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't King Arthur specifically, but there was something like that. Was it a Robin Hood? He got put in something where he was the big lead of some epic, and it flopped.
God. Yeah, and then there was the Miami Vice and the...
Right, Miami Vice was another one where it was like, Ken Colin Farrell, here's Colin Farrell, your new movie star. And he never really popped as a movie star, but I think he's had an excellent career since then as a character actor.
Yeah, there's life after that.
Sometimes
and sometimes some guys find it later in life. Like you look at the work that Richard Gere is doing now, or Kevin Costner. like late in his career. You know what I mean? Like, and that may be his thing. And I'm not saying he's not talented, but it, I don't know. He hasn't put it all together yet for me.
Yeah, no, I hear you. All right. So do you want to do our movie pick'em for next week?
Because yeah, look, there definitely was a part of me. It was like, why this one, Kolsky? Why am I here?
And again, the answer is like, this was a movie that seemed interesting to me. And I failed to consider that there are like 6 to 8 movies over the over last week and the next two that seem interesting to me.
It was a reasonable selection. And the other part of that answer is because I hadn't taken any initiative to get any movies on my own. So,
correct.
So let's
now, one film
that.
I saw, so that's on the table already. If you want to see it, is Colossal, starring Anne Hathaway. And if I can give you my 30-second review, which you can take or leave, it is a movie that, if you see it, will lead into a conversation I do kind of want to have about how tone in 2017 confuses me a lot, and I wonder if it's me or the world that's going crazy. Other than that, I would say leaving the movie, I feel like I like Anne Hathaway more and Jason Sudeikis less, although that is not necessarily a reflection on his acting.
Interesting. I'm very interested in the premise of this movie, which is basically a girl creates disaster in her personal life and it is analogous to a monster in the world, right? Am I getting that correct?
Broadly, yes, but it's more than analogous, I guess, is all I would say.
Right.
It is undoubtedly an interesting movie that I would enjoy talking about.
Okay,
I cannot necessarily give it a better review than that.
So yeah, I'm very interested in that. The one thing for me is I'm not 100% sure how available it is to me, so I need to figure out if it's playing in my town.
Oh yeah, okay. So that's one. So that's in the conversation. Here are other movies that I have specifically noted as things I intend to or want to see. Obviously, the aforementioned Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. I certainly will see that is out already. The aforementioned King Arthur comes out on Friday. I don't feel determined to see that, but it's on my list. Snatched, starring Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn, comes out this Friday, tomorrow, as it were. Baywatch, starring The Rock and Zac Efron, comes out later this month. There's a movie called Slight. Have you heard of this?
I'm not sure that I have.
Well, this is probably another one you'll have to check on availability, but it's an indie movie, came out a couple of weeks ago about a street magician, that has gotten some good buzz. It's directed by a guy named J.D. Dillard, who, sort of semi-famously started as a receptionist at Bad Robot. And it has, no major actors in big roles, but Dulé Hill has a small part. And then we have also got, sorry, I lost the page. So Slight, and then Baby Driver, which comes out, I think, next week. But that is the new Edgar Wright movie about a young man named Baby who is a getaway driver. It stars Kevin Spacey, among others.
Oh yeah, I'm interested in that.
That one comes. Oh, never mind. You know what? That we've got. I don't know why I've seen so many ads for it. That we've got plenty of time. Take Baby Driver off the list. That's in June.
All right.
So we're talking Colossal, Guardians, Slight, Snatched.
I'm voting
King
for
King Arthur are probably the ones on our plate.
I'm voting for Colossal or Guardians.
Okay. Well, I will probably see Guardians regardless, and I've already seen Colossal, so get to work, brother.
All right. And that's that'll be your homework for this week as well. I think that's pretty much all I got for people.
Yeah, let's give it a break. Go to the movies. Treat yourself.
Treat yourself.
All right, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the lights out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the jello is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.
Ready? And all right, Matt, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll start. All right.